Welcome to Unity Fort Worth Online. We are a spiritual center of love and wisdom, affirming God's presence in our lives and reaching the larger community in ever-increasing circles of good.
So everyone's done an awesome job now getting us to this place, right, of open and receptive to this amazing wisdom, which is transformative for all of us. And it's a good place to be to allow that energy to flow through us. You know, there's a huge difference between saying it and feeling it, isn't there? And we want to get to that place of feeling it so that it becomes a living reality. We're on a series. Our series is on great heroes. And last week we did Arthur. Next week we're going to do George Washington. And this week we're doing Arjuna. So we're covering the waterfront, folks. We're in Hinduism today, but we'll be moving back to the States next week. It's Father's Day, so looking at the great father of our nation. But today I want to look at the Bhagavad Gita, because the Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Lord is what it means, is probably one of the greatest spiritual texts that has ever been laid down. It's up there with the Bible and the Tao Te Ching and other wisdom texts of this world. And if we believe that God is no respecter of persons, then God can shine light through any vehicle. And I believe that the light of God is shining definitely in the Bhagavad Gita. And the lead characters in the Bhagavad Gita are Krishna and Arjuna. And Krishna, of course, represents God. And it's interesting, Krishna and Christ have a very similar sound, because I see them as one and the same, because the essence of divinity within us is the Christ. It's the Krishna consciousness, if you like. Same thing, just different name. And Arjuna represents that soul who is searching for the truth, just as we all are. And so Arjuna is every man, every woman. So we are searching for that and higher understanding, I think. And the Gita tells us how to do this. I remember being given my first Bhagavad Gita in Calcutta, of all places, back in 1976. And initially I didn't read it, but then a few months later I picked it up and I've been reading it ever since. I have numerous editions because there's so many different translations of the Bhagavad Gita. It's on my top 10 list for summer reading. And so if you want to get a copy, there's some in the bookstore. This one came out recently. It's called The Bhagavad Gita, A Walkthrough for Westerners. I kind of like that. A Walkthrough for Westerners by Jack Hawley. And, of course, one of the classics is the Penguin version by Juan Mascaro. And this one by Eknathiswaran, great Indian teacher who lived for many years in California, the Bhagavad Gita translated by him. And, you know, it's only 18 chapters. It's readable. You know, look, it's not that thick, is it? You can read it. But it's part of a bigger text called the Mahabharata, the great song of India, which is like 2,100,000 verses or something. It's just huge. And it's the longest epic poem ever written. And but they handily did a condensed version for us, which contains the sort of the spiritual meaning. The other one is an epic about all the history. This is the essence of the meaning of it. It starts in a predicament. And I would suggest that if you're human on planet Earth, you are in a predicament. Is anybody in a predicament? I mean, let's be fair. We all are. The predicament is, how do we live a skillful life, right? How do we acknowledge we're human, but we're also divine, right? We're spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe governed by spiritual laws. Great. But we still have to live our lives. We still have to go to work. We still have to deal with our families. We still have to make sense of all this ball of wax. We get into kerfuffles. We get into upset. We get into division and divisiveness. How do we deal with this? So that's the predicament we're in. And it's the predicament that Arjuna faces, because he's at the battleground and he's battling people who belong to his same clan, basically. They are related. So it's like, how can I fight these people when I realize they are one with me? You know, we're brothers, ultimately. And this is true if you accept the whole human race as one. Then we've got a predicament if we're in a battle zone with other members of the human race. But deeper than that, it's also a kind of metaphysical war that goes on, the war within our own selves, from divisiveness to unity. You know, how do I overcome them and us? Because it's so easy, isn't it, to see it as them and us. And we see it writ large in our society right now. And unfortunately, we could spend days ourselves being upset with somebody else. Ever done that? And it sat, no, nobody's going to do that. But it saps our strength when we end up in divisiveness. So the predicament is, how do I live skillfully, right? And Arjuna is so upset that he can't even take another step forward. He's given up. He said, I'm not going to even go there. I don't want to go to battle. I don't know what to do. But he does one good thing. He doesn't bemoan it alone. He calls upon God, right? He calls upon Krishna. And Krishna in the story, of course, is in his human form. So he can converse with them, just like Jesus is in human form, although the Christ is universal, right? So it's bite-sized. It's somebody we can relate to, right? So we need God to show up in a form that we can relate to, I think. In this case, Krishna shows up. He looks just like a human being, except he's kind of blue. He's a blue dude. And so he looks a little different, but apart from that, you know, apart from being blue, he's a regular guy. He also has a little bit of a glow about him, too, but, you know. So, as I said, let's read some of the passages here. This is from chapter 2, because basically chapter 1, he spent moaning about why he should do this, and they sort of give you an introduction about the two great clans. There's the Pandavas and the Kravas. And listen, we could be talking about that Bhagavad Gita till the cows come home, because there's so much enshrined in here. I'm trying to hit the highlights, okay? And Krishna says to Arjuna, this despair and weakness in a time of crisis are mean and unworthy of you, Arjuna. How have you fallen into a state so far from the path to liberation? It does not become you to yield to this weakness. Arise with a brave heart and destroy the enemy. Well, the enemy is not outside of us. The enemy is our own doubts and fears within, right? Arise. It is, and he's speaking to us, this despair and weakness in a time of crisis. Every moment is a time of crisis. Every moment is a time of opportunity. If we start labeling it as awful and terrible and critical, we've got a problem, right? But if we start labeling it as opportunity, then we can rise. We can rise beyond that despair. It does not become you to yield to this weakness. That's Krishna talking to each of us, because he knows better about us. And he invites us to know better too, right? Didn't Jesus say that too? I have come that you might have life and have it abundantly. It doesn't become you to be moaning and giving up and being weak. But it's not as simple as that for Arjuna. He says, yeah, okay, I understand, but it's still tough. It's tough. I got to be honest here. I don't know the way forward. Help me. And Krishna says, you speak sincerely, but your sorrow has no cause. The wise grieve neither for the living nor the dead. There has never been a time when you and I and the kings gathered here have not existed, nor will there be a time when we will cease to exist. As the same person inhabits the body through childhood, youth, and old age, so too at the time of death he attains another body. The wise are not deluded by these changes. In other words, there's an underlying reality that's continuing regardless of all the changes in our lives. The impermanent has no reality. Reality lies in the eternal. Those who have seen the boundary between these two have attained the end of all knowledge. Realize that which pervades the universe and is indestructible. No power can affect this unchanging, imperishable reality. And guess what? You are that. The body is mortal, but he who dwells in the body is immortal and immeasurable. Therefore, Arjuna, fight in this battle. Do what is yours to do, however unpalatable it seems to be. Yes? That's what it's saying? One man believes he's the slayer, another believes he's the slain. Both are ignorant. Because, folks, when we're in this win and lose, guess what? We all lose. Yeah? It's not one is the slain and one's the victor. No. When we're in that divisiveness, we all lose. Both are ignorant. There is neither slayer nor slain. You were never born. You will never die. You have never changed. You can never change. And born eternal, immutable, immemorable. You do not die when the body dies. Realizing that which is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and unchanging, How can you slay or cause another to slay? Remember that song? I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. That's pointing to the same truth, isn't it? There's an undying, eternal truth that's within everything. And you can fight it all you want. You can insist on being in a world division, divisiveness. But ultimately, even when you're in the pain of that, there's still the beautiful law of the universe flowing, right? So our work is, instead of getting sidetracked, is to come back to center, isn't it? To come back to that eternal truth which is at the heart of us. It's called Krishna. It's called the Christ. It's called that glow of knowingness. Whatever you name it, I don't think it matters. The important thing is that we make contact. Yeah? We contact that place. He goes on to say, they live in wisdom in who see themselves in all and all in them, who have renounced every selfish desire and sense craving, tormenting the heart. Neither agitated by grief nor hankering after pleasure, they live free from lust and fear and anger. Established in meditation, they are truly wise. Fettered no more by selfish attachments, they are neither elated by good fortune nor depressed by bad. Such are the wise. They are forever free who renounce all. And this is the key of it. This is the key of the book. They are forever free who renounce all selfish desires and break away from the ego cage of I, me, and mine to be united with the Lord. This is the supreme state. Attain to this and pass from death to immortality. Now, here's the thing. It's not good enough to find the Christ within yourself, you know. You have to, once you've found it within yourself, automatically find it everywhere else, yeah? I did an interesting exercise in my mind. I haven't done it in actuality yet, but somebody said, you like your altar at home, don't you? It has lovely images that inspire you. I said, yes, I do. How about putting images of the people you really detest on your altar? No! I don't want to do that. It's my place of safety. It's my place of where I lift myself up. But if it's a place of love, you can put your so-called enemies on there, can't you? Yeah. Guess so. But I thought, wow, there was a resistance in me, and I knew it was the right thing to do. So now I'm sneaking up to people I don't like and taking photos. So somebody said the other day, they think you like them, you're taking their photo, but oh, the absolute truth is the opposite. So if I take your photo anytime soon, don't judge it. Don't judge it. But you may end up on my altar. But the beauty of this is, what are we doing? We're seeing the Christ. We're seeing the beauty in that person. We're not seeing the problem that they are, right? We're seeing them as a beloved child of God. And in so doing, I'm freeing myself. That's the key. I'm freeing myself of seeing division and separation. I'm trying to live from the same consciousness that Krishna is inviting Arjuna to live from in the Gita. And it's enshrined in a phrase in Sanskrit called nishkama karma, which means desireless action, selfless action, selfless service. It means you can't stop doing stuff, but you do it from a higher purpose rather than from a selfish purpose. You release the outcome. Right? You release having to have it the right way for you. You get beyond I, me, and mine, and you just simply do it because that's who you are, a being of generosity, magnanimity, largesse, right? That's what we are when we're in our spiritual place, and then I can behold the Christ in you. I can behold the Christ in anyone. That's what I'm called upon to do. That's the ultimate. The book teaches us many ways to do that, and that's why I encourage you to read it, because there's so much in it that's helpful. You know, we're all different, so we have different ways of approaching God. You know, there's the path of the intellect, they call it jnana yoga, the path of trying to work it out up here, you know. Many of us are like that, highly intellectual, we want to know, I want to study, and that's fine. That's one path. But then there's the path of bhakti, which is the path of devotion. And I want to feel it in my heart. I want to make connection. I love nature, so I make the connection in that way. or I want to chant. I want to get in touch with the beautiful images of God and feel their energy. So that's the Bhakti yoga path. Then there's karma yoga, and that is consecrating all our action to God. You know, we have to do work, so let's do it as worship. And then there's Raja yoga, the royal path, which includes all kinds of things, but it's centered in meditation. And there's a beautiful chapter 6 on meditation, if you want to read about that in this book. Different ways of approaching, right? The important thing, as I say, is to make contact, isn't it, with the Spirit in whatever way that is for you, right? There's no right or wrong. It's enshrined for me in this chapter 9. Let's read this, because I think it's beautiful the way this is phrased. It says, "Whatever I am offered," says God, "whatever I am offered in devotion with a pure heart, a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, I partake of that love offering. Whatever you do, make it an offering to me, whether you cut hair or whether you're a neuroscientist or neurosurgeon, right? Do it for me. Make it an offering to me. The food you eat, the sacrifices you make, the help you give, even your suffering." Wow. Offer up your suffering as well as an offering to God. God will accept it with love. In this way, you will be freed from the bondage of karma and from its results, both pleasant and painful. Then, firm in renunciation and yoga, with your heart free, you will come to me. That's the promise. I look upon, listen to this one. Love it. "I look upon all creatures equally. None are less dear to me and none more dear." That's why we have to have them on our altar. "But those who worship me with love live in me, and I come to life in them." Isn't that gorgeous? "Those who worship me with love live in me, and I come to life in them." Isn't that what we all want? We want to be fully alive, don't we? We want to be filled with that energy and power, that generosity and magnanimity that is the God-centered life. You can tell somebody that's just talking and somebody that's feeling it. The one that's feeling it is attractive and has charisma and has energy, and you want to be there, you want to be around that. But those that are just talking about it, sounds great, but there's no contact. It's funny, at 9:30 I was bemoaning the fact we were working out all the glitches of the service because everything seemed to go wrong. Even my microphone died on me, everything. And I thought, yeah, but you know, that's what we're talking about, renunciation here, folks. You got to give it up. But we did the work in between services, and it came out great at 11. So that just shows you, now relax, relax into it. All is well. You don't have to fight the law, because if you do, the law's going to win. You don't want to be breaking rocks in the hot sun. "I miss my baby, and I feel so sad. I guess my race is run. She's the best thing I ever had. But I fought the law. And the Lord won." We can go into a lot of details that is explained in the Gita about the nature of energy and Shakti, and then the nature of spirit itself. But what's important to me, it's like yin-yang. It's an interconnection between spirit and nature that creates this whole thing, right? It's the masculine feminine energies. They go into a lot of detail about it. They go into a lot of detail about the qualities we have within us, the sort of sattvic qualities of spirit, the rajasic qualities of energy and activity, and then the tamasic qualities of inertia. And we have all these, you know, in our own being. We have couch potato qualities. We have always on the run qualities. And then we have peace. But they're all part of the makeup of the way it shows up here. I can't get into all the details. If you're interested, like I say, look into this. I do want to read this one, though. A couple more passages to read. This one is from chapter 13. Oh, by the way, there's a great passage where Arjuna has been talking with the blue boy for a while, and he says, "Hey, listen, I think I'm ready to see your real form now, your cosmic form." And Krishna says, "Nah, I don't know about this. You know, you sure?" And Arjuna says, "Yeah, I'm sure. Come on, show it to me." So then, you know, Krishna turns into this thing that's larger than the universe, and it's got all kinds of strange energies and powers and intense heat, and you name it. And Arjuna says, okay, come back to the blue form again real quick. You know? Because it's hard to deal with the energies of God. You know, they're so magnificent. We can be in the flow of them in the right and perfect way for us, but don't think you can put God in your pocket, right? You can't. God is much too magnificent for that. But I love this one. It says, he who sees the Lord in all is ever the same in all that is. Immortal in the field of mortality, he sees the truth. And when a person sees that the God in herself is the same God in all that is, she hurts not herself by hurting others. See, that's the key, isn't it? If I'm hurting somebody else, ultimately I am hurting myself, right? When I realize we're all one together in this, then she goes indeed to the highest path. And finally, I want to read from the last chapter. This is 18:45 to 47. It's funny, there's so many translations, and I have favorite bits from different ones. There's a wonderful translation that Donna Fronberger gave me a few years ago. I think for my 60th birthday, that's a very, very beautiful one, and lovely, and I've used that quite a bit, so thank you for that gift. It says, they all attain perfection when they find joy in their work. You have to work, whether it's a job, or whether it's getting up in the morning, or whether it's putting energy to what it means to be alive, right? We all have to work. They all attain perfection when they find joy in their work. Hear how a man attains perfection and finds joy in his work. Okay, yeah, I want to hear. Okay. A man attains perfection when his work is worship of God, from whom all beings come and who is in all. Greater is the work that you do, even if it's humble, than the work of another, even if it's great. Do your own work. When a man does the work God gives him, no sin can touch this man. So let's sum it up in three easy ways. I'm not going to do a pop quiz, but what have we heard today? What's the essence? What's the takeaway? What are you taking with you from the Gita that's useful? Offer it up to God, okay? Don't try and fight it. Offer it. Renounce. Make a connection to your own divinity. Yes. Whatever that means. Don't be attached to the outcome, right? Because you have everything you need right now. You are God in expression, right? Then it becomes joy to renounce, to release. There's a key here. It's within us all. Yeah. We are all one. We're all one. And we can get joy from each other when we give up the idea of them and us, of division, right? Then it becomes a joyous experience. I'm going to conference this week. It's going to be a momentous convention, a unity convention. It happens in Kansas City. But the reason it's going to be momentous is because they're talking about an assessment for the Association of Unity Churches. We give a love offering right now to support them, talking about an assessment, so you'd have to give a certain percentage. Also talking about where are we as unity. You know, many of the churches are getting smaller and closing. Unity has now been co-opted by Joel Osteen and Oprah and all these people, so we're no longer as unique as we used to be. Are we going to become a denomination? Are we going to fade away? What's going to happen? A lot of people are in fear around it. A lot of people are excited about it. A lot of people, of course, are throwing their heads up and saying, oh, my God, it's going to hell in a handbasket. So we shall see how it goes. But there's a man I know, Richard Levy. He's been a minister of unity for many, many years. He's dying of cancer right now. He's in hospice. And he wrote a little, it's on the screen now, put up a little message for the folks who are going to convention. And I thought, it's not just for convention. This is an inspiring statement for all of us. So for our community, for each of us individually. So let me close by, we can listen to what Richard has to say.
Thank you for listening. This ministry is funded through the generous contributions of individuals just like you. If you have found spiritual enrichment here, please visit us online at www.unityfortworth.org and make a donation. We thank you for your contribution and affirm with you. Divine love flowing through us blesses and multiplies all that we give and all that we receive.